Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. The Baker Lipid Series, Part 4, Adherence Matters. Strategies for improving the lifelong management of high cholesterol.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane. Statins, we know, are the most effective oral lipid-lowering therapy and are the first-line treatment for lowering LDL cholesterol. However, despite being the gold standard for treating cardiovascular disease, poor adherence to statin remains a real problem both here in Australia and globally. Large studies have revealed that almost 50% of patients prescribed statins have stopped taking them by 12 months. And non-adherence may be both intentional and unintentional, and there are many reasons for suboptimal adherence. Today, we are talking to Associate Professor Adam Nelson about the importance of patient adherence to lipid-lowering therapies and what GPs can do to try and ensure that their patients stay on these crucial life-saving therapies long-term. Dr. Nelson is an interventional and general cardiologist from the Royal Adelaide and Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide, South Australia. Welcome, Dr. Nelson.
Great to be with you, Anita.
So to start with, can you remind us, GPs, of the treatment options that are available for lowering LDL cholesterol?
Yeah, sure, Anita. So look, as with a lot of chronic disease management, our first strategy is around non-pharmacological treatment options. And unfortunately, with LDL cholesterol, very little we can do with our diet impacts the levels in a meaningful way. So the reason for that is because 80% of our levels are driven by our genetics. So we can blame mum and dad. It doesn't mean that you've got a single gene, familial hypercholesterolemia, but what it means is that the levels are determined by how we handle our cholesterol that is at a genetic level. And so the best way to treat that, therefore, is with medications. And so you've mentioned already that statins are the most effective, affordable, well-tolerated medication we have available to us, and we can see lowering of up to 50% with high-intensity formulations. We also have ezetimibe. And now we have PCSK9 inhibitors, which are administered in an injectable form. So we're a sport for choice now with ways to lower cholesterol.
Mm. And so what I'm hearing is that just like in hypertension and diabetes management, we need to think about even sometimes combining the therapies that you just mentioned to help us achieve those appropriate targets.
So important, Anita. And I think this is anticipatory guidance for our patients. You know, if you're starting with an LDL cholesterol of above 3.5, even a top intensity statin is only going to get you half the way that you need to be. And so, you know, starting that with patients and saying, look, I'm going to start you on this medication. We're going to see how you go. But there's every expectation that we're going to need to add a second. And for patients whose levels are very high at baseline, we may need to move to an injectable. And that's a much easier conversation to have in follow-up than it is when they come back and they come in and they're very excited that their levels are going to be better. And then they're underwhelmed or deflated that we're having to add another therapy, this idea that they've failed one therapy.
So we know that the large proportion of patients who are prescribed lipid-lowering treatments are not reaching their targets, which is appropriate for their level of risk, often on account of, say, poor adherence and persistence. Can you give us an idea, firstly, of how common is non-adherence to these LDL-lowering therapies? And secondly, why do patients do so?
It's a huge problem. The literature very clearly shows that around about half of our patients aren't taking their medications as prescribed, and that may mean that they're having them less than daily, or maybe that they're having them at times that aren't as intentioned. And that's not just the same for statins, that's for antihypertensives and antihypoglycemics as well. So chronic disease management, daily tablets is challenging. I mean, I don't know about you, Anita, I get through my 5 of 7 days of antibiotics and I forget the last couple of days. And this is me once a day. So
correct.
Our patients are having multiple tablets at multiple times a day. This is not easy. But what we do see is that, particularly in the statin literature, around about half of our patients by 18 months, despite having had an event, this is established coronary disease, are not taking their lipid-lowering therapy as prescribed.
So non-adherence is a huge problem. This obviously means that their LDL level is not going to be reduced to an appropriate level when patients stop taking their medications. What are the consequences of non-adherence for such patients?
Tablets only work when they're taking them. And so if patients aren't taking their tablets, they're not going to reach their treatment targets. We also know that non-adherence patterns and behaviour patterns link with other elements of constructive health. So, for example, the non-adherent patient to medications is less likely to get their influenza vaccination, is less likely to quit smoking, have perhaps lower levels of health literacy. So there are a clustering of elements that then relate to worse CV outcomes for these patients. So it ought to be a bit of an alarm sign and to lean into that conversation. I mean, Anita, we see that around about 50% of clinicians actually ask their patients about adherence. So if we're not asking about it, we don't know patients are struggling with it, you know? And
yeah.
you know, I try and step up to that chat. You know, I say to them, tablets are not easy and I want to go through each of them with you. I want you to recognize that every tablet I've got you on either should make you feel better or live longer. And if not, I want to toss it. Because you and I have seen patients come in with bags of tablets, half of which are from the Nature's Own aisle.
Yes.
And, you know, suddenly they're choosing that rather than having their dual antiplatelet therapy. So I think, you know, there's a lot to unpack around that process.
And you're right. If you don't ask, you won't know. And they're not going to volunteer that information. But I guess you've got to do it in a very sensitive manner.
I say to patients, I don't know about you, I say to them, you know, how many days do you miss them? Or, you know, are you taking them more days than you're not? You know, and sort of step up to it, a bit like how you're asking about alcohol.
Yeah.
You don't ask them if they're having two or three drinks, you're having four to six, and then they feel comfortable admitting that. So, you know, I think it's a step up to it to normalise the challenge of this. This is not easy.
Yes. And I sometimes even say, you know, if I have to take tablets, I forget. So I make them feel less bad about them admitting that they're doing the same. Now, we hear a lot about patient intolerance, whether it be real or perceived. Now, how common is true intolerance to statins? And what impact does this true intolerance have in terms of discontinuation of drugs?
Anita, we could talk about this for hours. This is a real challenge. I mean, there is no better studied class of medication than statins. And the randomized controlled, placebo-controlled trials very clearly show that the rates of muscle symptoms are no different or marginally different between placebo and active arms. And yet when you unmask participants, the rates of these side effects increase, which suggests that there is some nocebo effect. It is a real problem in clinical practice, despite the fact that the randomized controlled trial suggests that only about 1 in 12 symptoms are probably attributable to the statin, around about 1 in 3 in clinic. And I see a cholesterol clinic, so perhaps I'm a little overrepresented in that group, but around about 1 in 4 to 1 in 3 patients prescribed a statin will report some sort of side effect that they have falsely or correctly attributed to the statin. And so that's a chat. You know, that's a half an hour for me. You don't have half an hour with your consult if you're talking about a bunch of other things. So that takes a lot of time to then try and step through how related is this symptom temporally to the statin? What have they tried before? You know, that takes a bit of time to unpack.
Yes. And it's really interesting that you say a majority of the aches and pains that people report are actually the nocebo effect. And if, you know, you kind of talk through that with the patients and tell them, look, aches and pains are a fact of life. A lot of us, I get them. And then it may not be the drug, but also like sort of give them some modified treatment regimes, which I guess you could tell us more about later, that maybe almost 70% of these intolerant group actually can tolerate statins. But you just need to, as you say, have that conversation and clarify to the patient that the aches and pains are not directly attributable to the statins, but there's other reasons for it.
That's exactly right. If they have had issues in the past, I'll make sure that we've got a baseline CK, a baseline liver function test. I'll make sure that they're vitamin D replete. We know that vitamin D deficiency can cause some of these muscle symptoms in and of itself. And so taking that off the table, I want to understand exactly what they tried before, how they tried it, and what symptoms they got. And then I will deliberately say, well, let's stay away from A and B. Let's try C. And as I mentioned, start at a very, very low dose. And, you know, I've got a bunch of patients that are on Rosuva 5 alternate daily. We can achieve about a 15 to 20% lowering of their LDL. And it's a great start. And it may be that over time, we can, with some more confidence, start to push that up. Unless you validate their concerns and at least address them and try and understand them, you're going to lose them. And if you've lost them, they're not taking their tablets, their LDL's up, they've got residual risk. We're, no one's doing any favours there.
Yeah. Oh, I think you've given us some great tips, you know, because we know the statin-associated myopathy, or SAMs as they're called, are cited as the commonest reason for discontinuation. So you kind of validate some of their fears, but then give them the information that helps them understand better that they're not really related to the medication.
Yeah, one thing I do, Anita, I'll give them the script and I'll say, I want you to fill this in a week, but for the next week, I want you to put an alarm on your phone and I want you to think about when that alarm goes off, have you had a muscle ache or pain for the last 24 hours? Allows them to do for this week without starting a tablet is to see, are they getting aches and pains? And what they will see is that the majority will have an ache or pain over the course of a week. You've mentioned you do, I do as well. And so when they start the statin, you can then sort of get an assessment of a baseline level of symptoms. And then this is almost the equivalent of the N of one studies, demonstrating some sense that there is some baseline symptoms, and attributing them to the new medication is not necessarily causal.
That's a really clever way to do it, actually. And patients are testing it themselves, so they're going to believe then what happens. These are great tips. Fantastic. We can really implement them and win a lot of patients over with this kind of approach.
The other thing to say is that patients often, if they understand why they're taking the tablet, whether that's for blood pressure or dysglycemia, then they're more likely to engage in it. And so what I will show patients, particularly those admitted with an MI, is I'll show them their arteries and I'll show them the one that we've opened up. And I'll say, look, we have squished that plaque to the edge. The artery looks beautiful. But if all we've done there is empty the bath and left the tap on, we haven't done you any service. So now it's about getting that cholesterol low. And I show patients a figure and I show what a lipid-rich plaque looks like. And if we can get LDL below 1.4 and in some cases 1.0 millimole per litre, we shrink that lipid core, we remove some of the inflammatory milieu, and we turn plaque off. And so patients then get a sense of, well, the number no longer is important. What's actually happening in the arterial wall is important. And we engage them in that chat. Patients aren't pot plants anymore, Anita. They want to understand why they're on what they're on. And if they can see some potential benefit, some plausible mechanism whereby this daily medication is going to make me feel better or live longer, then at least they can buy into that.
Now, there is some evidence that adherence can decline sharply in the first 6 months following initial therapy. Hence, I guess it's really important that GPs follow up with their patients soon after we commence statins. Now, how does this follow-up impact, you think, on patient adherence? Does it help? Is it a good sort of strategy?
Yeah, a huge amount. We recommend they see their GP within 2 weeks for two reasons. One is to make sure that the medication list is reconciled and that there's a need for a further prescription, potentially at that 4 week mark. The second main reason is that patients can come down 6 months down the track and they've got a sore arm. They say, oh, by the way, I had a heart attack 6 months ago and I'm on these tablets. So, you know, the idea of seeing the GP and making sure that this is a some degree of transfer of care is so important. The first visit I arrange is that 6 to 8 week mark where we can do a repeat LDL cholesterol and see what the impact of the high intensity statin and ezetimibe often, combination therapy up front post-ACS, and to see what the effect of that is. And at that juncture, we can consider the use of injectables once we're stable for, you know, ideally 3 months as per the PBS. So for me, that regular touch point is important because you've mentioned already that this vulnerability of patients in hospital, deer in headlights, that settles as they start to feel better within a week or so. And so suddenly then we're up against maintenance of smoking cessation, maintenance of good blood pressure, maintenance of LDL. This is the marathon, not the sprint anymore. And so that frequent contact, that initial touch point at 3 months, but then again at 6 months and 12 months.
No, you're right. Every encounter is like an opportunity to revisit and review and reiterate all the advice you give them and talk about adherence again, talk about why. And I guess, like I said, it's not just the cholesterol we're looking at then. We're looking at their blood pressure, their glycemia, this comprehensive cardiovascular risk reduction we can constantly implement by seeing them frequently. We've discussed that many patients need more than two drugs. As you said, the statin may not be enough, then you add the ezetimibe, and then sometimes they're still not on the LDL targets. And you've mentioned the PCSK9 inhibitors. Now, how do the PCSK9 inhibitors factor into this treatment approach?
So for patients who aren't able to achieve the targets, and it would be important to mention that as we have gone on and we've got more intensive lipid-lowering therapies available to us, and the data continues to show that lower is better for longer and ideally earlier, our goalposts have shifted. So for patients with established disease, our target is 1.4 millimoles per litre, and even those at very high risk, potentially even lower than that, 1.0 millimoles per litre. So we would love for all of our patients to get to those sorts of targets post-ACS particularly. The challenge is that oral therapy will only get us some of the way. And so where patients remain with an LDL of 1.8 or greater than 1.8 millimoles per litre, despite maximally tolerated statin and ezetimibe. And so that also means, Anita, if patients get muscle aches on 80, Atorva 80, but can manage Atorva 40, that's their maximally tolerated statin plus ezetimibe. And they have got sufficient enrichment. And what I mean by that is they've got either multivessel disease or recurrent events, polyvascular disease, or they've got diabetes with end organ dysfunction. There are a variety of different PBS hoops to get through. Those individuals are eligible for PCSK9 inhibitors. And the reason for that is that from a health economic point of view, we know that the highest risk patients are more likely to derive the most absolute benefit. So these are the people that we target most with very intensive lipid-lowering therapies like the evolocumab monoclonal and inclisiran, the siRNA. And these are agents that we can offer our patients at the highest risk. I love that we now have inclisiran and Leqvio available. I think what's most important is we give patients options. So evolocumab is administered 2 weekly, subcut injection. I've got patients who like that locus of control of being able to administer the injection on their own time, whenever they like. But now we have inclisiran, which works in a very different way. Is done at baseline, 3 months, and then 6 monthly booster. That is done in a healthcare environment, and that sort of takes the adherence element out of it or supports patients by doing it in a healthcare environment. So a bunch of my patients you put side by side and they say, would you want the 1 2-weekly at home or do you want the 6 monthly? The 6 monthly is a pretty easy sell for most patients. They like that idea, you know, and GP recall systems facilitate some of that. So
it works well.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think the most important thing is that we give patients options and we try and achieve their goals. And these are therapies that can lower LDL on top of statin, on top of ezetimibe by 40 to 60%.
Which is phenomenal. Yeah. Yeah. So the PCSK9 inhibitors have definitely been a game changer, I guess, for in, you know, our armamentarium to help lower LDL to, in those very high risk patients. And like you said, you know, we have two options. Give the patients the choice and then make the decision. And as GPs, we do find, as you mentioned, the 6-monthly injections working really well when we're giving their denosumab or they're coming in for the 6-monthly refills. We know that adherence isn't a problem because we've given it to them. It's administered by our nurses. So that does help.
And they come in, they get their blood pressure checked, you reinforce smoking cessation, you offer them a flu vax. I mean, there are a whole pile of things we can do to cluster the care around that.
Yes.
And the other point you make, Anita, is that, you know, you're doing the majority of the lipid prescribing in the community. Primary care is doing the lion's share of the work here. And pleasingly, a couple of years ago, it was very clearly mandated that GPs can initiate these medications, because when that comes from you as their partner in life, that is a huge benefit. But we're only going to get our goals achieved if we're doing this together. And I think when primary care take the bull by the horns here, we've got a much better chance of being able to do that.
Definitely. We GPs are at the forefront of lipid management and we need to be proactive. And the recent streamline authority for inclisiran has made life even easier for us GPs. So Dr. Nelson, thank you for taking us through the issues around non-adherence to lipid-lowering therapies and what we GPs can do better in order to overcome that. Could you please summarize the key messages for our GPs to take away from our discussion today?
First thing I'd say is that non-adherence is common in the community, and unless we ask about it, we don't understand the intentional or non-intentional nature of that from our patients. And to really step up to that conversation in a normalised way, in the same way we take an alcohol history or a drug use history. The second thing I'd say is that you continually reassess this. So patients will move in and out of adherence and non-adherence. This isn't a binary classification. So helping patients understand where there are dynamic elements, is it cost, is it intolerance, is it side effects, is it decision-making, is it health literacy? And I think with that in mind, GPs who touch their patients far more frequently than I will in specialty care have a real good opportunity to take a pulse and a barometer of how patients are going and to lean into that chat and to help them understand where there are knowledge gaps around the benefits or, more importantly, the risks of non-adherence. It's such an important part of their ongoing care. And I guess from an LDL cholesterol management point of view, we've mentioned already the stepwise management that does breed a bit of inertia, and the importance of combination therapy for particularly high-risk patients, and this idea that we start to discuss cholesterol management in the same way we do with hypertension and diabetes, that for the most part, you might end up on 2 tablets plus or minus an injection. That's a much easier step up in follow-up than it is when patients come in underwhelmed, deflated, frustrated that they haven't achieved their goals. This is teamwork, and it's great being able to work with primary care physicians who are motivated to try and help their patients achieve their goals.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Anita.
Please note the PBS information for Leqvio, inclisiran. Authority required, telephone or online, for patients with hypercholesterolemia. Refer to PBS schedule for full authority information. Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Novartis and produced in June 2025. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.